Good evening, Tapsters. This is Jonathan J.M. Rowe, your producer here at This Is Vinyl Tap. As you know, earlier we posted the first of our first ever two-part episode looking at The Clash's legendary double album, London Calling. Before we present part two, I'd like to say on behalf of Doug, Tony, and myself how much we've appreciated you downloading the show and sharing the good news of the podcast with your fellow music lovers. Please continue getting the word out about the show, and in appreciation, we promise never to review an album by Foreigner. And so, without further ado, This Is Vinyl Tap presents part two of our deep dive into the legendary album by The Clash, London Calling. Take it away, us!
In 1948, Columbia Records introduced the 33 and a third RPM long player record. 1 year later, RCA Victor introduced the 45 RPM single. Listeners now had a choice, only the hits or the full album. In the last half of the 60s, the best bands realized the potential of the longer format and began to build a cohesive body of music that must be heard unbroken. The arrival of downloadable music has increased the temptation to stay in the shallow end with the hits. This podcast believes every album tells a story. Tonight, we tell one of those stories. All right, Jim, you got a song for us?
Lost in the Supermarket. I'm lost in the supermarket. I can no longer shop happily. I came in here for a special offer. And this one is probably just the most carefree, fun song that they have on the album. I don't know. There might be other ones, but this one to me is just when I listen to it, it's just like, hey, this is a nice little image. Supposedly it was a song written by Joe Strummer with
Strummer.
He got Strummer. Sorry. Joe Strummer.
Good name for a guitar player.
Yeah. He started writing it, thinking about Mick Jones just walking around in a supermarket with his mom when he was young. And Mick Jones, I think, didn't like it at first, but then he actually wound up writing a lot of the lyrics for it.
I think he sings this one too.
He does sing it. I think it's the bassist he was writing about. I could be wrong, but one of them lived in a flat. And so, you know, the character in the song is able to hear all these arguments going on around him because they live in a tenement flat, I guess.
Jones living with his mom and grandma.
Okay, so it was Mick Jones. Okay, I apologize.
They can hear the guys upstairs.
Well, and it's interesting because that one line about the first, I guess it's the first line where he talks about, oh, he's looking to buy a personality, you know, I think that's what it says. So it's this weird kind of, the song, you're right, it's jaunty. It doesn't seem like there's a whole lot there, but then when you dig into it, there's this thing about, you know, the loneliness of growing up in that environment and hearing everything going around you, but also trying to find yourself through the shallowness of consumerism. You know, that's what he's kind of trying to talk about there. But yeah, it's a fantastic song.
One of the things I like, my favorite part about this song is the ending, because it almost sounds like it doesn't end. Have you noticed that? That bass just kind of, okay, well, we don't really know how to end the song, so we're just going to stop playing.
Well, I'm going to say something that's probably not very popular, but this song brings this up. And maybe it was just impossible in 1979 for this to be a thing, not to be a thing, but there is an undercurrent of a disco beat that goes through a lot of these songs.
Oh, that's sure.
True.
That's you know?
True.
In fact,
this is supposed to be the thing saving us from disco.
Right, exactly. But it infuses it. It's, you know, I mean, they didn't do what Blondie did, which is just entirely embrace disco and makes disco songs. But I think a couple of the songs on this album actually charted in the U.S. on the dance chart.
I love that.
You know, it's just kind of interesting that was
a deal, definitely could.
That's the revenge of the man. All right, Tony, you're up.
All right, let's see. What am I going to talk about? I am going to talk about I'm going to talk about Clampdown. So Clampdown is
a song I love to hate.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because it was the second single release from this album, but was only released as a single in Australia. I don't know the marketing behind that, but I think lyrically, and this may go into what you want to talk about, Doug. I think lyrically, it's probably the most quote unquote punk song on the album. You know, it's all against, you know, the idea of settling down and selling out and mindlessly conforming to the whole establishment type of thing. And that if you do that, then you're feeding into the system that's responsible for mindless bigotry and oppression. When you're talking about Clampdown, it's just going to be about this whole idea that the government's a fascist entity, right? But then there's that line about the men in the factory and, you know, and how you end up sort of supporting that system by just giving up and going to work in a job like that. You know, what does it say? But you grow up and you calm down. You're working for the clamp down. I mean, this idea that just not doing anything is actually supporting that system, right? And then the Clash, of course, comes back and says that what's the line? Let fury have the hour, because anger can be the power.
So, well, this song summarizes my entire relationship with this album. I got this album in high school. This is definitely a high school album for me. And I almost felt like it was mandated for me to have this album. And even though I think this album is mostly post-punk and a lot of it's exploring a lot of other genres, the attitude is definitely 100% punk. And it was that attitude that always drove me crazy. And even as a young guy, is, hey, everything that happened before us sucks. And this song's really about how screwed up it is that you eventually have to go to work. And it's like, why hasn't the government mandated that all services and products manufacture themselves? And we still have to, it's like there's this alternative to work, and it's always driven me crazy. I've always viewed punk. I think punk is to rock and roll what rock and roll was to music. It's coming out and it's rebelling against this guy that rebelled against his parents. So this is the grandson rebelling against a rebellious father. And I can remember it was such a contradiction, because the punk thing in my high school or in Austin was, we're nonconformist, but they all looked exactly alike. Yeah. And we're tough, but all of them had the skinniest arms and the sunken chest. And they looked like they hadn't been in the sunshine for years. And they were all wanting to tear down everything, but nobody had blueprints for anything else.
Well, and I don't think you can miss the point that at the time, someone of Joe Strummer's political leanings would have been extremely upset with the fact that Margaret Thatcher was about to become prime minister.
Yeah.
I think that saved them a lot of money. Well, I think that infuses this song as well, especially the name of it, you know, the idea that the government's going to be going down and putting the boot on people trying to go outside of the system. I think that infused it. Regardless of all of that, it's a great song.
If this this album were in a different language, it would be one of my favorites. If I didn't know what the hell they were talking about. They're sitting there mad about capitalism in a country that has 83% top tax rate. And they're the biggest posers in the world. They act like they don't care what anybody thinks, and they're the biggest posers in the world. Watch that bass player. He's got it down by his knees. Like, that's easy. That's posing if I ever saw it.
Well, they all have it down by their knees. That's a whole punk thing. And he's like 6'7", and he's sitting there trying to play bass.
You know what? I'm sorry, but every time I see Joe Strummer in an interview, I'm captivated by the guy.
I know. He's a brilliant.
No, just anytime. The guy, I mean, even if I didn't agree with what he was saying, the guy was captivating to me, and he didn't, and you know, he wasn't a dope by any stretch. No. There's a lot of people that sing from a certain perspective that are just dopey about it.
When you hear him talk about himself back then, it really has softened my attitude on the whole deal.
Even his public persona was very different from his private persona. He was supposedly one of the nicest guys you would ever meet.
There's these really odd pictures online. He evidently got healthy at one point and was running marathons. And there's pictures of him running marathons with, you know, with a mohawk and everything. It's just, it's just bizarre.
Yeah, you know, and he died walking his dog.
Yeah. No, I mourn that day. I think the world's a sadder place without Joe Strummer in it.
I agree.
Jim, do you have another song for us?
So I'm going to go with probably the biggest controversial, the song that is going to stir the most controversy. Guns of Brixton. This is a song by Paul Simonon, who I'm not entirely sure what it's about, but I've heard it's about a very paranoid guy, but I also heard it's about some unrest that's going on in Jamaica at the time. And that's not an easy bass line, by the way, as a bass player.
All the bass lines in this album are really interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
And this song... it makes a reference to The Harder They Come, which is considered the first reggae movie, which covers some of the same issues that the song covers.
It's my least favorite song on the album. Well, I know.
I'm sure Jay appreciates that.
Well, no, I'm just saying this is a song full of great, or an album full of great songs, but this is my least favorite. It's dub reggae. I don't know enough about reggae to know anything about the subgenres of it, but evidently dub reggae is somewhat electronic infused, I guess.
Yeah.
I do find it interesting though, because prior to this, I think Mick and Joe didn't like Paul Simonon exerting himself. And then he wrote this song. It's the first song written by him to appear on an album, and they insisted he sing it too, you know?
Yeah.
So he's singing lead on it as well, which is kind of a cool thing. I mean, it's like it's their version of Ringo, I guess. I don't know.
He even said that he wanted somebody else to sing it, and he even didn't think it was good enough to put on the album, and Joe Strummer said, "No, this is great. You got to..."
Well, they had to pat it out to a double album jam.
All right.
I'm
Smarty
sorry.
Pants, you're up.
I'm sorry. I'm being a jerk. What can I say?
Everybody in the audience expects that, Tony. It's part of our shtick.
Is that part of my shtick? How about Hateful?
I love that song.
Damn, is that one of your songs?
It's one of my songs. It's a fantastic song.
Yeah, and it's sung by Mick as well. I think Joe wrote it. It's about heroin abuse, and it's as anti-drug as it could possibly be, which was not necessarily a thing a lot of punk rock bands were embracing at the time. I mean, the Ramones, their bassist was a heroin addict, and he wallowed in it. And obviously same thing with the Pistols and some other bands. But so evidently one of the things that inspired this was while they were touring the States, Sid Vicious died, and they were obviously close to him, part of the same movement and same part of the, you know, world. And that impacted Joe Strummer a lot. Musically, it's interesting because it's definitely influenced by Bo Diddley to me, this song.
Yep. Sure.
Definitely. You know,
yeah.
But again, it's just a fantastic song. It's funny. It seems to me like a lot of songs on this album where you can get into it musically on one level and it's kind of fun and whatever, or it's got a nice, you know, you're enjoying it. And then you start listening to the lyrics and you're like, oh, God.
I know. It's gut-wrenching.
Well, it's another one of these that is immediately accessible. It engages you immediately. There's no period of listening to this over and over again, like some people do with, say, Yankee Hotel Foxtrot, never make progress.
Well, and the other interesting thing about this, I think you said this about another song. You can hear this song in a million songs that came after it.
Yeah. I think the Boomtown Rats popped into my head after listening to that again.
I can see that. I can see that. Yeah.
JM?
I don't know if this is my favorite song on the album, but it is definitely the one that I just keep coming back to, The Card Cheat. The few piano driven songs on this album, and if this is a punk album, it's one of the few piano driven songs on any punk record. I can only think of like stuff Iggy Pop was doing with John Cale that might fall in that category, but incredible song.
So I told you guys that wasn't going to be the one I mentioned Springsteen before. That wasn't going to be the last time I mentioned him. This song sounds like a Springsteen song to me. It just has that feel to it. I don't know why. Maybe it's the piano driven stuff to it, or maybe it's the fact that it's kind of telling a story. It's very narrative. But it does remind me a lot of a Springsteen song. Mick Jones on this album in particular learned how to do is be adept in the studio, which served him well later on. I think it was one of the things that drove the Clash apart, because he started exerting his influence more on what he wanted the sound of the band to be. But he double tracked this entire song to get that Phil Spector wall of sound thing going on, which I guess is what Phil Spector used to do. They would mix the song and then they would just lay one version of it on top of the other version. And that's essentially, I think, what they did here.
Then they also, Phil Spector would invite everybody walking down the hall to come in and play something.
After he showed him his gun.
All right, Tony, what do you have for us?
Jam, we both seem to be dancing around the title track, so I'm just going to go ahead and talk about London Calling. London calling through the faraway towns. Now war is declared and battle come down. London calling to the underworld. Come out of the cupboard, you boys and girls. What's that, calling? Is that a good one? Yeah, it's a great one. It was the first single off the album. It didn't do anything in the U.S. It's interesting because the title comes from, you know, back in during World War II when the BBC would broadcast to soldiers in occupied areas, they would say this BBC London Calling BBC or something like that. So that's where that comes from. And obviously these guys, you know, were aware of that kind of stuff. It's an interesting way to start the album. I mean, I think it definitely kind of tells you that you're, and we say this a lot, it tells you you're kind of in for something a little different. It doesn't sound punk at all to me. Yeah. I have a question for you guys though. What the heck is phony Beatlemania?
Well, I already talked about what I think. That's everything that came before us sucks.
Yeah, I don't know if that's the case. I think
it plugs into that.
I don't know if that's the case or not. I kind of think it. I think because the line preceding it says "Don't look to us," I think you might be talking about the punk scene and all the kind of hoopla around the punk scene.
I love this song. I think it's one of the most fantastic openings to any album ever.
Yeah. I don't disagree with that at all. And they kind of throw everything at you. I mean, it's just like Joe telling you what's wrong with the world in 1979 is all laid out here in this song, you know?
And it sounds like a call to action. They want you to start marching to the tune they play. Yeah. And they create discord, and they really don't resolve. This music doesn't really resolve. It resolves a little bit when he says, I live by the river, and I think, I don't know if they did this purposefully or not, and I don't know if I'm making this up, but basically there was an idea at that time that the river was going to flood the low areas around it, And so he's basically saying, well, there may be nuclear power plants about to blow up, but it doesn't matter to me because I already know I'm going to drown when this river rises. So it's ironic because he lists all of these problems and he goes, but I live by the river. So too bad for y'all.
Well,
I get to die.
And the song ends, which I never really knew about, but it ends with the play with Morse code playing SOS at the end of it.
It's another layered song that if you actually listen to it through your headphones, there's backwards guitars going through that. I'm guessing that's Mick Jones' influence on it.
It does have a great bass line. I mean, it's right what Doug said. It sounds like it's a call to arms and they want everyone to just march towards oblivion, I guess. I don't know. But it's fantastic.
It's perfect for his voice.
It's again one of those songs that you can just hear a million people influenced by after this album came out.
Well, and I've heard a million other people sing this song and I'm talking about very talented singers, but no one has the right voice. It's got to have that.
You're right.
It's almost like the way he sings, it's like he was up all night shouting at a football game. And this is what's left of his voice. And it's perfect for this song.
Well, and JM mentioned that, you know, Mick Jones, you know, noodling around doing all this stuff. I mean, evidently Guy Stevens was kept out of the studio once they were kind of done with everything. And and Mick Jones and one of the engineers were the ones that were kind of putting all the finishing touches on it. And yeah, he put overdubs in and did all kinds of stuff on this album. Like I said, it's kind of where he learned how to do that, you know, trial by fire, but it really works.
And I'll tell you another thing. Tell me a song that's like it.
Yeah.
There's not one.
I mean, I cannot think of, well, it's kind of, no.
Nope.
I can't think of a single one, not in the English language. All right, JM, there. Now you got
my to turn. Follow that up. The right profile.
Everybody say what's he like?
This is about the car accident that Montgomery Clift had that left him in pain and sort of precipitated his downfall in Hollywood.
It's that use of irony they do with these tunes that don't match the subject matter at all.
It's not a very nice song in a lot of ways.
Yeah, because the right rope, because it supposedly it was the one of his, I can't remember if it was the left side or the right side, it was kind of permanently paralyzed from that.
Yeah, and so he was always, when he would make movies after that accident, he would he'd talk about wanting the right profile. The interesting thing I think about where he got the subject matter was Joe Strummer was always enamored with American pop culture, like a lot of Brits are, just like we're some of us are enamored with UK pop culture. And Guy Stevens, I think, turned him onto a bio or maybe two bios about Montgomery Clift. So he was reading about that at the time and thought, I'll write a song. Man, the piano and the horns on this song are great.
Yeah. All right. Now, after that pregnant pause, we'll go back to Tony.
I was just going to say, I'm going to pick my second favorite song on the album, which is Train in Vain. Which was the third single they released. It actually, this one was a hit though. This hit someplace, which is odd because it's nowhere listed on the album. The name of the song has nothing to do with what they're singing about. But it charted. It got to number 23 on the Billboard Hot 100 and number 30 on the Billboard US Dance Club chart. But interesting story about this was they were, I guess, Mick Jones was recording it. They were recording it for a flexi disc that was going to be in the New Musical Express magazine, a giveaway or whatever part of that. And that fell through. And so they decided to put it on London Calling at the time. And this was part of that whole thing about, you know, including it as a single so that it'd be a double album, an extended single. And so this song was added to it. But that's why it's not on any of the sleeves. The sleeves are already done. And it's the only song that doesn't have lyrics printed in it either because of that on the album, which makes sense. Although I've heard, and I don't know this because I don't own it on vinyl on the original vinyl, that the name of the song, title of the song, was scratched into the runoff area on the fourth side. But how odd is this that this became a hit? And, you know, people would go into the store and say, "Hey, I want that Stand By Me song." And they're like, "Huh?" Because no one knew what train. It's evidently named because of the it had kind of a train driving, you know.
Yeah.
It's incredible. That was that tells you how much of a great tune it was that people would overcome the fact that it's not on the cover and overcome the fact that its name has nothing to do with the song. You'd never intuit the name of the.
I think what's kind of cool about this album in particular, so you've got this song, which was what, you know, if you were to just ask people about a Clash song, they'd probably know this one. So this album has one of their most well-known, most beloved songs on it, but it also, in London Calling, has a song that kind of is maybe the quintessential Clash song as well, you know?
JM, what do you got next?
All right, Lovers Rock.
To love a girl right, you wanna make lovers rock, you must know a place you can kiss.
This song reminds me of Shout by the Isley Brothers, which I also think Sam and Dave covered, which maybe they heard on their tour that they went on with Sam and Dave. Even right down to the oohs and ahs that permeate this song. It just sounds to me like they're having a complete blast when they sing this song.
Tony, I believe you have one more for us.
I do. I'm not down. And I'm not just telling you I'm not down. That's my song choice. I'm not down. Which is written by Mick Jones. I believe it's semi, if not completely autobiographical. I think it had to do with his breakup of his girlfriend at the time, who was in the female punk band The Slits. It's another one of those songs that's upbeat as hell, but when you listen to the lyrics, the lyrics aren't upbeat, other than the fact that it's defiant. You know, he's talking about how awful things are for him right now, but he's not down. But that song, that song is just fantastic. It just is, you know, again, that weird juxtaposition between being a song that you're bopping to, and then you realize that it's a little heavier than that when you actually pay attention to it.
Yeah.
I know we were only sticking to four songs, but I did want to talk about one song that was 11 or maybe 10 and a half for me.
Well, we always have an 11 on this podcast.
And that's the Four Horsemen. To me, sounds like the Clash doing the Who.
Yeah, I agree with you 100% on that one. And the ending piano part on that it sounds exactly like a Who song.
Well, and right in the middle, that line where he's like, he says, "You're not searching now." There's like those drum rolls that sound like Keith Moon, and you can just you close your eyes and see Pete Townsend doing his kind of sweeps during that part. And then
how many people were in the Who?
Why?
I don't know. You think there's a connection?
Maybe. But here's something I read about online, and I went back to listen to the song after I heard this. The opening chord of it is essentially the opening chord for A Hard Day's Night.
One of the most famous openings of any. Well, one of it was somebody put a guitar up against the amp. And something started humming in that song, I believe. That's one of the legends I've heard. I'm talking about The Hard Day's Night.
But yeah, if you go back and listen to that opening chord, I don't know if it's the same chord, but it's pretty damn similar.
There's three cover songs on this, and supposedly those three cover songs were ones they were rehearsing to kind of get their juices flowing to write.
You know, since we brought up the covers, it's worth listening to Revolution Rock just to listen to Topper Heaton's drums on and his percussion on it. He's just having a blast. I'd heard that they brought in a box of all these different percussion instruments and just said, go at it. Yeah. And this is one of those songs where he's definitely having fun kind of screwing around with that stuff.
Tony, what do you have for the kids tonight?
Well, I've got two things I want to talk about. One is an album that's a re-release, and the other one is another podcast. The album I'd like to talk about is an album by a band called The Mopes. They released an album in 99 called Accident Waiting to Happen. Easy for me to do. I keep holding back and I don't know why. I still and then it was re-released in 2018 on a label called Sounds Rad. I believe you can probably still get it on CD, maybe even on vinyl. It's kind of a pop punk, a late 90s pop punk super group. The lead singer is a guy named Dan Vapid. He was in a bunch of different bands. So it's significantly poppier than London Calling is for the most part, but it's definitely got kind of the reason I thought about it is it's got a spaghetti Western thing going on with it as well. So it's got all these different sort of elements to it that while not derivative or that much sounding like the Clash, kind of come from the same sensibilities, I guess, if you will. It's really great. If you like that kind of pop punk stuff, you'll love this this album. So some standouts on this album are the lead off track, My Heart Won't Bleed for You, is great. Hang 'em 10 High is also a great song. A song called Circle K, which is fantastic. I mean, it's really, like I said, more on the pop spectrum of things. So it may not be for everybody, but worth checking out if you like that kind of stuff. The other thing I wanted to mention to you guys is a Spotify podcast called Stay Free, The Story of the Clash. It's hosted by Chuck D. And for those of you who don't know who Chuck D is, he was in a hip hop rap band called
Public Enemy. Public
Enemy. And he does a great job. He evidently had an affinity for the Clash because he was a disc jockey at one point, and a guy convinced him to go into the music business based on how similar he thought his persona was to Joe Strummer's. So that kind of is infused to that. I think it's 6 or 7 episodes, but it's really, really good. Very historical. Some of the stuff I talked about tonight, or we talked about, is from that as well, that I just learned through that. But it goes into while we went into more in depth on this particular album, it goes into more in depth on just kind of the general story of the Clash, but it's definitely worth checking out.
That's it for tonight's show. Tune in next week when we'll be looking at one of the biggest albums in country music, Willie Nelson's Redheaded Stranger. Be sure and download us on your favorite podcasting platforms such as iTunes or iHeartRadio, Amazon, or Spotify. Follow us on Twitter at TappingVinyl or email us at TappingVinyl@gmail.com. Leave us a review or a comment on the show. We'd love to hear from you. So for our host, Doug Cooper, our co-host, Tony Slagle, and me, your humble producer, Jonathan J.M. Rowe, thanks for listening to This Is Vinyl Tap, where all the podcasts go to 11. And reminding you, don't you wrong 'em, boyo.